This is Stateside. I'm April Bear. Michigan's history has always been full of wild stories about cops and robbers. Retired FBI agent Greg Stascoll has lived through quite a few of these. He worked for the FBI from 1976 through 2006 on assignments ranging from violent crimes to bank robberies, white-collar crime, organized crime, narcotics, and terrorism squads. The Bureau's focus has shifted a lot over the years, and the course of his career marks many of the major changes in law enforcement. Greg Stascoll has just published a new book called FBI Case Files Michigan, Tales of a G-Man, and he joins us now. Greg Stascoll, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You say that this book is not really a proper autobiography, nor is it a memoir exactly. Why did you decide not to handle it that way?
Well, I didn't want the book to be about me, nor did I, and I emphasize this, that nothing in my career in the FBI was done by myself. And I didn't like the idea of, hey, look what I did kind of thing. I wanted to tell the stories and give credit to as many people as I could. And I think they're great stories, and that's how I approach the book. It's a book of stories about cases that I was involved with, most of them high-profile cases, but that's why I approached it.
You grew up in Nebraska in the 50s and 60s, and your family had a tradition of military service. But can you tell us about what you felt like you could do in the FBI that you couldn't do in other forms of service, either in military or as a police officer, some of the other avenues that were open to you?
Well, I'm not sure I looked at it as what I wasn't able to do in other services, but early on in my life, I sort of became enamored with the FBI and the idea of being an FBI agent, investigating crimes. And that was, I think, partially because of some of the things in the media. A book I read when I was in about the fifth grade, and the Jimmy Stewart movie, The FBI Story, all of these things led to that. I think also watching The Untouchables on television when it was a series with Robert Stack as Elliot Ness. I don't think a lot of people realize that the original story of The Untouchables that Elliot Ness wrote was about Prohibition and they were Treasury agents. But later episodes, when it became a series, they used FBI cases. And in effect, Elliot Ness became an FBI agent in that series.
Yeah. As a former Clevelander and knowing a little bit about his later career in law enforcement, a lot can happen when Treasury agents become sworn officers.
Yes.
So midway through 1975, you finished your FBI training at Quantico and reported for your first office of assignment in Detroit. And within just a matter of weeks, Jimmy Hoffa, the leader of the Teamsters, went missing. So there you were, front and center for one of the biggest investigations in the region in the 20th century. What do you remember about the first few weeks of what was going on in the Bureau around this?
Well, for me, as almost a brand new agent, it was almost overwhelming to have a case like that, obviously with national prominence, happen, and to see how the FBI reacted. I'm not sure most agents, maybe for their whole career, they're not as close to a case that early in their career, certainly, but maybe not even their entire career. And to see how it unfolded as far as the way we approached it, the things we did to investigate it, and then for that investigation to continue literally through my entire career.
I was surprised how I got drawn into the procedural, you know, stuff, just figuring out where he was and when, and how the FBI was pretty sure of what happened while everybody else was, you know, speculating. Jimmy Hoffa, of course, was never found and declared dead much later. Members of the Detroit Mafia, who were persons of interest in the case, Tony and Vito Giacalone, were prosecuted for other things. A lot of people were left with this feeling that the outcome of the case was a little less than satisfactory. Were there ways, though, that the Hoffa case set a tone for you or for your expectations about what FBI work would be like?
I think it did. First of all, it was interesting to see how the FBI approached the case, especially a case of that magnitude. You learn early on, I mean, you're taught in the academy how things are supposed to be done, but to actually see how the system and how techniques are actually applied in cases one of the first things you always do, and you learn it, I learned it early on in the Hoffa case, was to establish a timeline. It's very, very important to have a timeline and then work from there. That's what we were able to do. We did what we call a neighborhood investigation, where we flooded the vicinity of where Hoffa was last seen at the Maccas Red Fox near 15 Mile and Telegraph. And we were able to establish a lot of things. And then moving out from that point to, you know, motives, people that had reason for Hoffa to disappear, and what the possible motives were for that. All of the people that, as you termed it, persons of interest, all of those people, we had to determine where they were in respect to the timeline. And then also leading up to it, leading up to that day in July.
Yeah. You have a really interesting chapter in the book that's devoted to kidnappings. Could I ask you to read a little bit from it?
Sure. Interestingly, and also in that, my first year in the Bureau, I mean, technically, Hoffa was not a kidnapping. It was an abduction and ultimately determined to be most probably a murder. But there were actually several other major kidnappings for ransom my first year in the Bureau. So I wrote this chapter, Kidnapping for Ransom, as a bad business model. It was February in 1980 in Detroit. I was assigned to the FBI surveillance squad. It was very cold in the back of the van, as we had not yet installed a heater that would work when the van was not running. I had been driven to a spot where I could observe a ransom drop site from the small one-way window in the back of the panel van. The driver had parked the van and left. He was picked up a few blocks away by one of the other surveillance cars. If anyone was watching, they would think the van was empty. This was one of the many kidnappings I would work in my career as an FBI agent. As I would witness time and again, it was a lousy way for criminals to make money, particularly as technology improved. It became clear the business model simply did not work. And I think it's worth recounting why.
So, Greg Stayskull, at risk of undermining some of the joy of discovery in the chapter, why did most kidnappings fail?
Well, first of all, you have a kidnapping victim, and presumably in return, hopefully safe return of that victim, you want to collect a ransom. So you have to make contact with the person or persons that are going to pay that ransom. Well, just the act of making contact can lead to identifying who the individual is who did the kidnapping, at least eventually. And then you have to figure out a way for that ransom to be paid. Keep in mind, this was pre-Bitcoin, so we didn't have to deal with that. But basically, the form the ransom would take has to be delivered to a site where it has to be picked up. And in most cases, we made extraordinary efforts to surveil the ransom site. We always sort of stood back until we could get the victim safely returned. And sometimes, obviously, we had to pay the ransom before the victim was safely returned. And that was our primary goal. But then thereafter, we made extraordinary efforts to then determine who the kidnapper was. And ultimately, at least in all the cases I worked, we were successful at doing that.
I was shocked to read that kidnappings for ransom were as common as they were early in your career. Why do you think they were so, I guess, such a popular mode of going at it? You think just a lot of criminals looked at what happened with the Lindbergh case and assumed that they could pull off something similar?
Well, I actually think it predates Lindbergh, although that was obviously one of the most prominent in terms of coverage, because at the time, Charles Lindbergh, of course, had flown across the Atlantic solo and was arguably the greatest hero in the country at the time, and had a lot of adulation. So when his baby son was kidnapped, that drew tremendous amount of attention and sympathy, and ultimately led to kidnapping becoming a federal crime. Prior to that, it wasn't. In addition to that, during the 30s, the so-called gangster era, there were a number of gangs, some specialized in bank robbery, and others specialized in kidnapping. And the Barker Karpus gang, which included people like Machine Gun Kelly and others, they sort of decided they were going to specialize in kidnappings for ransom, and they did. And initially there was some success, but ultimately the Bureau, the FBI, became rather adept at investigating these cases. So it fell off precipitously, but for some reason, that first couple years I was in Detroit, actually the entire state of Michigan, we had several kidnappings for ransom. And those were all successfully investigated. We identified the kidnapper in every one of those cases that I'm aware of. Then you don't hear about them very much anymore. And I've come to the conclusion that in order for kidnappings really to be successful, you have to either have the police involved or at least willing to cooperate with the kidnappers. And that happens in Mexico and South America and other places, but not here. So I guess that's the reason, at least the best I can figure.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is retired FBI agent Greg Stascoll. He worked out of Michigan field offices for several decades, and he's just published a new book. It's called FBI Case Files, Michigan, Tales of a G-Man. Greg, the book's second chapter concerns a scandalous series of deaths and a case that I've wondered a lot about, the so-called Ann Arbor Hospital murders. People at Ann Arbor's VA hospital in 1975 started suffering respiratory failure at alarming rates. And this was mostly concentrated among ICU patients. And some of them died. The FBI identified at least 38 cases in which people were found to be poisoned by a kind of muscle relaxant. And there were these two women, Filipina Narciso and Leonora Perez, who worked as nurses at the VA. They were both from the Philippines. And they were both accused and put on trial. A number of folks in the community rallied to the nurse's defense. I know this was a complicated case, but I wanted to ask, you sort of suggest in your retelling that you think investigators had the correct suspects or were on the right track. Can you give us a sketch of your reasoning?
Sure. The big thing was, and again, a timeline plays an important role in this. To paraphrase Sherlock Holmes or Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, you eliminate the impossible and everything else that remains, even though it may be improbable, is the truth. I don't know that that's always true, but we were able to establish a timeline, interestingly, because the poison that was used was called Pavulon. And Pavulon is the synthetic version of curare. Curare is a muscle relaxant, a very strong muscle relaxant, that was used on the darts and the blowguns in the South American Indians. But what happened in this case was we determined that the curare was injected into the patients. And what happens is they go into, because of the strength of the Pavulon, rather, because of its strength, they went into this asphyxiation. Their heart would continue to beat, but they were basically asphyxiating. And there were 50-some respiratory arrests that happened at the Veterans Hospital that summer of 75. And one of the anesthesiologists at the hospital, a woman by the name of Ann Hill, determined that she saw these as being symptomatic of an overdose of Pavulon. So she started using the antidote, and it worked. And so we came to the conclusion that these patients were being intentionally given this Pavulon. Later on, as the investigation continued, we found a Hungarian doctor, Dr. Frodel, who actually wrote the book on this stuff and determined that the muscle relaxant had to be put in the IV tube. It couldn't be in the bottle, and it would have caused the asphyxiation within 2 to 3 minutes. So now we had our timeline. Whoever was doing this had to be in the proximity of the patient that had this asphyxiation. And it had to happen within that 2 or 3 minute period. So what the FBI did was determine who was in proximity to the extent we could, every one of those 50-some cases where they went into this asphyxiation. So We were able to identify only two people that were in proximity in every one of these cases. And it was Filipino Narcissus and Leonora Perez. And we actually found some eyewitnesses who saw what appeared to be, in one case, it was a victim, but that victim died prior to the trial, so wasn't able to testify. In another case, a family member walked in when Leonora Perez appeared to be putting something in the IV tube. She then walked out of the room, and within minutes, the person went into respiratory arrest. So with all of this information, we came to the conclusion that they were ultimately charged, at least with the ones we had enough evidence to prove. And ultimately, when we went to trial, and at the time it was the longest federal trial in U.S. history, and the jury came, after a long deliberation, came back and convicted both women of having played a part in the deaths and the asphyxiation of these patients.
At the same time, there was so much circumstantial evidence in the case, and so much hung on that 3-minute window that the labs were able to come up with as having been critical. It's true, you know, they were seen in the room, but again, this was a situation where witnesses were describing what happened with the suspects back to them. The prosecution's case was not able to establish a motive. Neither of these women was described as anything but conscientious and hardworking. And there was so much clouding of the issues around the fact that these women were from the Philippines. I mean, one of the survivors, Richard Neely, who had been supposed to testify before he died, had referred to them as slant-eyed bitches and had this conspiracy theory that Filipino nurses were coming to the U.S. to murder American vets. I mean, I understand that investigator's job is to, you know, that you have to, there were all these deaths. This was a huge case that had to have some kind of resolution, but how can we say that they weren't innocent when we can't really rule out the guilt of several other suspects who were working at the hospital?
Well, again, first of all, I would like to emphasize, and having had some involvement in the investigation, what the FBI did was take the facts where they led us. And again, I go back to Sherlock Holmes and that, you know, we eliminated the impossible. The point was, in all of these cases, not just a few of them, all of them, These both of these women were in the proximity of the patients, even though some of the patients that had respiratory arrest were not in parts of the hospital where these two nurses were assigned. In other words, they were away from where their assigned spots were, but they were in proximity within that 2 or 3 minute window. And again, the 2 or 3 minute window became key. Without it, I don't know that we could have proven the case. And the jury, obviously, they didn't convict them on all the counts. I think they considered the case very carefully. Part of the problem for the nurses was it was decided by their defense to put them on the stand. And when they were on the stand, both of them were caught in situations where they were lying. And the jury recognized that. And that, I think, was a key factor as well. The other thing, as far as motive, it would have been very helpful to the prosecution if we could have shown some compelling motive. The best we could do was that these nurses were hardworking and conscientious, but they also strongly believed that the hospital was understaffed. So one theory of a motive was that they were trying to demonstrate how understaffed the hospital was. It seems like a very drastic way of demonstrating it. A lot of people question that. I'm not sure that's the motive, but it makes as much sense as anything else.
You were around long enough to see so much change, both in terms of investigative techniques and the way that science and technology has been used to deal with evidence, changes in surveillance technology, the digital tools for committing crimes and for investigating them, and also just some big shifts in the Bureau's work orders, a shift toward counterterrorism. Can you tell us a little bit about how you managed to roll with all the changes that you saw over the years?
Well, the Bureau, I think, mirrors society in the sense that it's very dynamic. You know, when I joined the Bureau in 1975, basically computers were unheard of. The internet didn't exist, nor did cell phones exist. So these are all things that changed over time. But the Bureau has made an effort, and not in all cases have they moved as quickly maybe as they should have, but they have. And I think, as you say, a lot of the priorities have changed. When I came in, organized crime was a huge priority. And I think we made tremendous strides towards diminishing the power of organized crime. And counterterrorism has been an issue, especially since 9/11. But now I see that, you know, we are going, and it's not really a step back, but we're opening up more of an effort to address the issues of domestic terrorism as opposed to international terrorism. And I think that's been demonstrated by the emphasis that's put on the investigation of the insurrection on January 6th.
Greg Stayskull, thank you so much for talking to us. Greg Stayskull's new book is FBI Case Files Michigan, Tales of a G-Man. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Well, thank you, April. I've enjoyed it.